From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Parlez-vous hockey? They certainly do in Montreal. This week on Only a Game, the Habs are the last hope in these NHL playoffs for hockey-proud Canada. Can they go all the way? And veteran sports journalist Pat Jordan explains how he goes about profiling some of sport's biggest names.
If you're a good guy, I'm the best guy in the world to show up at your door because I just want to get you the way you are. I want to capture you as you are. If you're not a good guy, maybe I'm not the best guy to do the story as far as your image is concerned.
Also ahead, Danica Patrick becomes IndyCar's first female champion. We'll ponder Patrick's win and the future of the once-split, now-reunited IndyCar circuit. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Montreal Canadiens of yore were talented, quick, and confident, the closest thing the National Hockey League had to royalty. But they last won the Stanley Cup in 1993. The 2008 Canadiens are young, younger, and Russian. They were talented, quick, and confident enough to earn the right to play the considerably more physical Philadelphia Flyers in the second round of the NHL playoffs. On Thursday, the Habs tied Game 1 with 28 seconds left in regulation and needed only 48 more seconds in overtime to score the game winner. The two teams will meet again tonight in Montreal. Joining me now to comment on that series and perhaps other hockey matters as well is Pat Hickey, who covers the Canadiens for the Montreal Gazette. Pat, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having me.
With such an exciting victory, I am a little surprised there was hardly any rioting in the streets of Montreal. Don't these fans care?
Well, they certainly, I don't know if it was the fans caring, but we certainly had some rioting after they won the first round playoff. That used to be reserved for the Stanley Cups. You know, it seems that there's a new level. I don't know if it's a reduced expectations here in Montreal that they figure this is the only chance they're going to get to go out and celebrate. It's unfortunate that they had the problems that they had. There were thousands of fans in the street and a handful of troublemakers. Certainly the thousands of fans in the street speak to the passion, the fact that they sell out this building every night. 21,273 fans, the largest building in the NHL. But it's unfortunate that the city had to take a public relations blow with the rioting the other night.
Well, it was a serious circumstance. At least 20 people were arrested and over a dozen police cars set on fire. I hope things settle down as the playoffs proceed.
First of all, there was a lot of public disgust over what happened, a lot of public opinion. I think that will affect the way some people act in the future, and there's certainly going to be an increased police presence. In addition to Montreal police, and last night or two nights ago for Game 1, they had the RCMP and the Quebec Provincial Police, equivalent of the state police in the States, augmenting the city force. So certainly, you know, let people know that if they are going to step out of line, they're going to be arrested rather quickly.
Let's get back to the series itself. The Flyers play a rough brand of hockey, and they did have a two-goal lead in Game 1 before they lost it. However, the Canadiens have won all five games between the two teams this season. What kind of a challenge does Philadelphia present as Round 2 goes along?
Well, I think they present a big challenge. The Canadiens aren't the biggest team, although they out-hit Philadelphia the first night. They out-hit Boston through most of that first-round series. They have what they call team toughness, and they have a way of bouncing up. The Gustafsson brothers combined on a goal last night, and both of them were knocked down on the play on the way to the goal, but they still managed to get it. So this is a resilient team. They were actually hoping that the Flyers might be a little rougher last night, because one of the things that helped them during the regular season was the Flyers playing an undisciplined game and giving the Canadiens some opportunities on the power play. Mm-hmm. Last night there were only two power plays for each team. Each team scored once, and the Canadiens also took advantage of on their penalty killing units, scored a shorthanded goal. So I don't think the Canadiens really mind it if the going gets rough, as long as they stay disciplined and don't take those retaliatory penalties that can hurt you.
The 1993 Canadiens were the last Canadian team to win the Stanley Cup. Now Montreal is the last Canadian team left in the postseason. Are all Canadians rooting for Montreal now, even the Canadians who regard French as a foreign language?
I think so. Yeah, I think that, you know, even before this, you had large pockets of Canadiens fans right across the country. This is going back to the days when there were only the two Canadian teams, one in Toronto, one in Montreal. And on any given Saturday night, you'd see one of them on television. And, you know, Hockey Night in Canada was similar to the Ed Sullivan Show in the United States. It's where families gathered around the TV on a Saturday weekend night to watch the games. Mm-hmm. And so there were always Canadian fans, even when the NHL expanded and went to Edmonton and Calgary, Vancouver, and finally Ottawa. When the Canadians or even the Leafs would go to those teams, they would still be fans with the old allegiances. And I know when Montreal played Ottawa in the last regular season game this year, there were a lot of people who I think would nominally call themselves Ottawa fans. But when the Canadians won the game, I don't think a lot of them were unhappy because they had been Canadiens fans at various times in their lives.
Well, it's always easier to root for the team that ended up winning
that's
anyway.
Right, that's right. It's always good to jump on the winning bandwagon. But, you know, I think that they'll probably win some new fans across the country, but I think generally, you know, Canadians are a fairly patriotic lot and will throw their support behind the Canadiens.
The Canadiens, the New York Rangers, and the Detroit Red Wings are three of the original six teams still alive in these playoffs. Are you personally hoping for a Montreal-Detroit matchup in the finals for the sake of old-timey hockey?
No, I'm personally hoping for a Montreal-San Jose final. I think that would be a good matchup. I think there are players on both teams that have played in the two cities. And I think that the weather and the city, and I'd rather spend a couple of days. I lived in Detroit for a while, and I don't find it as bad as some people do, but I think I'd prefer to spend a couple of days in San Jose.
Pat Hickey covers the Canadiens for the Montreal Gazette. Pat, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Anytime.
Most Americans only pay attention to eventing during the Olympics, if they pay attention at all. The sport combines the three disciplines of dressage, cross-country, and stadium jumping. But as international riders gather for an especially prestigious competition, the Rolex Kentucky three-day event, some who closely follow eventing are wondering what can be done to make the sport safer. Kathleen Adams reports from member station WUKY in Lexington.
55-year-old Ralph Hill doesn't remember the fall he took in March 2007 while going over the advanced cross-country course at Poplar Place Farm Horse Trials in Georgia. Instead, memories of that day come to him in the form of dreams.
Because he wouldn't bring his left foot out in front of him, he hit the back of the corner, and then the last thing I dreamt about was my face was about a foot from the grass. That's the only thing I remember about that course at all as far as that day.
Hill, a member of the 1980 U.S. Olympic equestrian team, who was also shortlisted for the 2000 Sydney Olympic Games, describes the fence that he and his horse Reprint crashed over as solid, the kind you can drive a tractor into and still not move.
It's a corner jump with wood on the top of it, and it's narrow on the right, and it looks like a V, and it widens out to 6 foot on the left, and then on the very far left, if a rider, you know, was struggling, there was an option that they could turn and go an easier way.
When the pair fell, they hit the ground together. As Reprint regained his footing, he stood on top of Hill, breaking the rider's right femur in over 40 places, crushing his face and left arm. A medical helicopter airlifted Hill to a trauma center where he spent over a week in the ICU before being transferred to a hospital closer to family in Kentucky. Hill had competed in high-level events such as Rolex for 3 decades, but the accident ended Hill's competitive riding career. Still, he believes the sport is safe.
I'd broken every now and then a foot or, you know, a collarbone or something like that, but I'd never been busted like this. and I've ridden thousands of horses, so it was just a freak mistake.
But other equestrians haven't been quite so lucky. At least 13 riders worldwide have died in the last year and a half while competing in eventing, with cross-country being the most dangerous portion of the three-phase event. Former Olympic rider David O'Connor, now president of the U.S. Equestrian Federation and chairman of the Safety Committee for the Federation Equestri International, says safety is a personal issue for him. His wife, Karen O'Connor, also an Olympian, still events at the highest levels.
We have looked at lots of different aspects of what is causing this kind of level of safety issues that we've had in the last 14 months. I'm not quite sure if there's one single easy answer. I wish there was a magic wand to have that, but the level of thought process that is going into it, I mean, this is a very big deal for our sport.
O'Connor cites the sport's growing popularity as one possible reason for the accidents. He says many riders today lack the foundation necessary to safely navigate the cross-country phase, where horse and rider must clear numerous fence combinations with the clock ticking. In the past, O'Connor says riders have had more experience.
They came from a fox hunting background. They came from a riding background. They came from a show jumping background. And they came to realize the thrill of eventing, the fun of eventing. Now, what has happened is that we have people that don't come from those backgrounds. How do we make sure that people have the qualifications and they are getting the right instruction and they're getting the competency level up to be able to come play at this sport, which has an element of risk?
But some of the injuries and deaths have occurred among the sport's top riders. And some people, like Ralph Hill, believe cross-country course design plays a role. They say courses at all levels are becoming more difficult and dangerous. But Michael Etherington Smith, course designer for the Rolex Kentucky three-day event and director of sport for British Eventing, believes recent criticism is unjustified. He says course designers do concern themselves with horse and rider safety. Still, whenever a rider or horse is injured on a course he designed, Etherington Smith says he feels a sense of responsibility.
As course designers, you never stop learning. There's always something new to learn. And you learn by watching, and you learn by understanding what you're watching. And the biggest critic is yourself. And, you know, you have to have that approach to things. And, you know, we all share, I mean, those of us who are lucky enough to travel around the world doing this, we all share experiences for the benefit of the sport.
Many of those intimately involved with the sport acknowledge that safety changes need to take place, but the pace of action has been slow. The USEF last December did approve rule changes that go into effect this summer that would ensure that riders are better qualified before moving up a level. And David O'Connor says more changes are on the way, such as the use of frangible pins that can be inserted into fences to allow the rail to drop when a horse hits it. Meanwhile, Ralph Hill has lasting effects from his riding accident. He walks with a noticeable limp and doesn't have full movement in his left arm. But a year after his fall, Hill is back walking and trotting aboard a horse. For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Lexington, Kentucky.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Somewhere Wim Hof, the Dutch gentleman who set the world record for sitting immersed in a tank of ice last February, is pouting or perhaps plotting a comeback. Mr. Hof's record of 1 hour and 13 minutes on ice was shattered recently by Wang Jintu at a club in Beijing. Mr. Jintu spent an hour and a half in a glass tank covered in bags of ice. He needed help walking when he emerged from the tank, but he was still able to wave to the audience. Wang Jintu's daughter was not surprised by her dad's record-breaking performance. She told reporters that her father had always been impervious to cold. Most of the time, he just wears short pants, even in winter, she said.
The Iceman. Here comes the Iceman.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a primer for those who would understand how racing leagues divide and then unite, perhaps to conquer. But first, on Sunday, Danica Patrick, former Rookie of the Year, became the first woman to finish first in a race on the IndyCar circuit. She won the Indy Japan 300. Joining me now to help put that achievement in perspective is Dr. Marjorie Snyder of the Women's Sports Foundation. Dr. Snyder, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much, Bill. Good to be here.
Janet Guthrie was the first woman to qualify for the Indy 500 way back in 1977. It took 31 years for a woman to finish first in an Indy race. How significant is Danica Patrick's win?
Well, I think it's tremendous. I mean, everybody's got to take their hat off to her. Not only did she, you know, win a race and beat a two-time Indy 500 winner in doing so, but she's kind of got the monkey off her back. I mean, she's a tremendous athlete and a tremendous race car driver, and I think everyone's been expecting her to win. So the fact that she's finally done it now, it's sort of like what happened to Phil Mickelson in the Masters. You know, it's really taken that pressure off, and I fully expect her to, you know, really raise the bar now and become a multiple winner in races. In terms of the perspective, you know, it just speaks to how difficult it has been for women to sort of break through in a sport in particular, which is completely male-dominated, from the owners to the drivers to the pit car racers to the announcers, and, you know, yet it has a tremendous fan base, certainly, that's probably got a lot of women in it. So, you know, hopefully this will really make her a role model for younger women coming up, and there'll be more to come.
I'm sure, having gotten the monkey off her back, as you say, she's really going to appreciate your putting more pressure on her by saying you expect more wins right away.
Well, I think she expects that of herself. So I don't think what I have to say about it is going to make a darn bit of difference.
Well, after years of frustration, Danica cried after her historic win, and later she would apologize, saying, "That was girly of me." Do you think we'll ever get to the point where being a, quote, girly champion isn't necessarily a bad thing, something for which one has to apologize?
Yes, and I think we're already there in some ways, because look at Tiger Woods. You know, after he won, after his father passed away, you know, mm-hmm. he cried. In his first victory, he cried. Like a baby. Mm-hmm. You know, you see the guys who win the World Series, they're all crying. And the Super Bowl, they're all crying. So
Brett Favre when he retired.
Exactly. So I really think we're already there. And, you know, is there a little more attention when a woman does it? Yeah, because people think, oh, just a typical woman. But I think if people would really, you know, take a look around and say, oh, right, the guys are all crying. Sports is probably one of the few places where it's actually okay for a guy to cry.
This week has given us an opportunity to look at various lists of firsts for women in sports, some interesting ones. In 1902, a woman named Madge Sayers entered the only figure skating world championship for men and came in second. In 1926, Gertrude Ederle became the first woman to swim the English Channel. She broke the men's record when she did that. Do you have a favorite first?
First, I mean, I think Gertrude Ederle probably ranks right up there. That one, more recently, I Julie Crone's winning of the Belmont Stakes, mm-hmm. first Triple Crown race won by a woman. I certainly think this Danica Patrick one is, you know, is a favorite because it just so breaks all the rules of, you know, the past. I think race car driving is sort of the last bastion of sort of what people would say, oh, cars, that's all about men. And, you know, Janet Guthrie was the first person to say, you know, the race car does not know I'm a woman.
This week has also given cause to speculate about what the next best women's first might be. One columnist went so far as to suggest that Pat Summitt, the coach of the women's basketball team at Tennessee, should be the next coach of the New York Knicks. I don't think Coach Summitt would want that job. She's turned down the men's job at Tennessee at least three times. But would it be a step in the right direction if she were to take it?
Well, I think that's bringing up a very interesting point, because although women have made tremendous inroads in participation opportunities, you know, at the high school level, the college level, and now even into the pro level with the WNBA and the LPGA and WTA are doing very well, and we're starting up the new women's soccer league, one area where women have made hardly any inroads is into coaching men's sports. Mm-hmm. You know, men and women have about half the opportunities in coaching in women's sports. So it's pretty 50-50 split. But in men's sports, really less than about 2% of all the jobs are held by women. We're talking about employment opportunities here. So, you know, I think most athletes want the best coach. Mm-hmm. So I think the reason they're talking about Pat Summitt being the, you know, the coach of the New York Knicks is, hey, she's a pretty darn fine coach. So who wouldn't want her to coach them? You know, I think she'd be up for a lot of jobs. She just, of course, has said so many times that she has, you know, the perfect job now. But I think that we do need to, just as we've been able to get the leagues like the NBA and the NFL to think about minorities and in their hiring practices, they think about that as only male minorities. We need them to be thinking about, hey, perhaps I should interview a woman for this job.
You make an interesting point. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I bet there are more female athletic directors at the college level than there are females coaching men's sports.
Oh, absolutely. And women have begun to make inroads there. We still only have about only something less than 20% of all the athletic directors at college level are women. So it's way more than the coaches.
What are some of the milestones you'd like to see female athletes or coaches reach?
Well, I think we should be careful not to, you know, spend all our time thinking about, can a single woman break through into a, you know, a male-dominated sport, and should we be always be comparing males, you know, performances against females' performances. What I'd really like to see is, you know, complete and total equity in terms of pay equity at the, you know, NBA versus the WNBA, and, you know, professional sport opportunities in sports like softball, where we don't have, you know, a women's professional league. So that would be great. In terms of the, you know, firsts in men's sports, I mean, I'm a huge baseball fan, so I'd love to see a woman on a baseball team, and I think she could play first base.
Or second base, or if she were a knuckleballer,
yeah,
she could pitch.
Yeah, I think she could do it.
Absolutely.
So we've had them at the minor league level. So, but that's going to be a single woman. You know, it's not going to be an influx of massive numbers of women, probably.
We're not going to have the Bill Veeck model of an all-female team suddenly brought into the league.
I don't think so.
No. Dr. Marjorie Snyder is with the Women's Sports Foundation. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
As we mentioned, Danica Patrick's win came in Japan at the Japan Indy 300, but that wasn't the only premier open wheel race this weekend. The Toyota Grand Prix was held in Long Beach, California, drawing attention and fans away from Patrick's win overseas. But as Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder reports, last weekend was the last weekend during which open wheel race fans will have their loyalties divided.
It's the morning after Danica Patrick's historic win, and I'm standing near the entrance of the Toyota Grand Prix in Long Beach, California. I figure it's as good a place as any to speak with a racing fan about Patrick's accomplishment. So when I spot Mike and Debbie Hernandez dressed in matching racing shirts, I approach them.
What did you guys think of Danica Patrick last night? Did you hear about that?
Oh, no, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, she won.
Oh, girl!
About a block away, I talk with three 20-somethings, kind of SoCal cool, dressed in black. One, Marisa, looks to be about the same age as Danica Patrick. That is, 26.
Why are you here today?
Me?
Yeah.
I come every year.
Surely she's heard about Danica's win.
Hey, did you guys hear about Danica Patrick last night? She won Japan.
That's exciting. Good for her.
Now, I'm aware that Danica crossed the finish line Saturday night while most Californians were at the movies or partying, so I can understand how people might not know. But if NASCAR raced in, say, Antarctica the night before, don't you think their fans would know who won?
What NASCAR did well was speak to the fans.
That's Lewis Frank. He writes about motorsports for ESPN.com. I've asked him to help me understand why so-called open-wheel racing has struggled recently in the U.S. while NASCAR has flourished. But before he gets there, he tells me why today's race, the Long Beach Grand Prix, is so important. Thing is, it's not that easy to explain.
What's happened is it's the end of the two open-wheel series, and it's a very complicated topic, and I won't even begin to go into it. But the key thing is it's important that there is only one open-wheel series because people get confused about it.
Right. Okay, let me try to simplify. Today's Long Beach Grand Prix is the last ever Champ Car event. Champ Car is one of the two series Frank was just talking about. The other series is called the Indy Racing League, or IRL. In 1994, the two split, and, well, things have never really been the same. Now, Champ is being absorbed by the IRL. It's a little bit like when the ABA joined the NBA. So, why is this all happening? Well, according to Ron Skelski, who works in the racing industry, it's in large part because fans were frustrated.
Nobody wants to follow a series that keeps splitting and keeps fighting. NASCAR has it together, and they have a lot of money behind it.
They exploited the split. They were growing.
Lewis Frank.
The problem was that in the open wheel, in the IndyCar series back leading up to 95, is you hardly saw a television commercial or magazine commercial with an IndyCar driver. However, it seemed like you could see almost every NASCAR driver on TV.
To make matters worse, the split was affecting Open Wheel's premier event.
If you say to people, name a horse race, they say Kentucky Derby. So same thing in the United States. People understand, and it's come in the racing business, Open Wheel racing is the Indy 500. That resonates with everybody.
What didn't resonate with fans, however, was that after IRL and Champs split, some of the best Open Wheel drivers couldn't race in the Indianapolis 500. Only those who were in the IRL series could. Champ drivers? Thanks, but no. It'd be as if all of a sudden only the NFC played in the Super Bowl and the AFC held their own Super Bowl or something. And while the NFC and AFC were trying to steal fans away from each other, this whole other thing called arena football was just booming. In motorsports, of course, that other thing was NASCAR.
For the past 13 years, you had these two series running in parallel, fighting each other. They suffered mightily. Once was the biggest race in the United States, and this is going to be very unpopular to some of my friends who listen, commercially, in my mind, the Indy 500 had fallen behind the Daytona 500.
Brian Davidson knows a thing or two about people who attend open wheel races, at least here in Long Beach. He sold merchandise to them for years.
Out of everyone here, probably 1% of these people even know the difference what Champ and IRL is. So most of these people are just here for the party and, the atmosphere.
And it is a party. Just ask Dan and Brett Haney.
You have fun at either one. NASCAR is more of the going out to the dorm and having a party. This is more of a party once you get out of college. So you're still having fun at either one.
That's more of a sloppy party. Somebody brought a keg, all right? And then somebody maybe brought a bottle of wine.
Exactly. That's basically it. The keg's at the NASCAR race, the bottle of wine's out here in open wheel.
But we're going to shotgun both of them.
But at NASCAR, when the race is on, all eyes are on the track. Here, well, there are so many things to distract you.
Loud hip-hop music, big, huge, inflatable Tecate beer can. It's a circus. Lifestyle expo. They've got sort of models hanging around.
Today's Grand Prix snakes its way 1.9 miles around downtown Long Beach, past the aquarium, zigzagging under overpasses and making hairpin turns. The few recognizable names in open-wheel racing were in Japan this weekend. So at the start of today's race, a 29-year-old Brit named Justin Wilson sits in the pole position.
Gentlemen, start your engines!
Shortly after the green flag drops, an Australian, Will Power, bolts into the lead. Nearly 2 hours later, he crosses the finish line 5 seconds ahead of the Frenchman, Frank Montagny. The crowd stands for the finish and lightly applauds. Then, as if the organizers had envisaged the lukewarm reception, a 5-minute fireworks display crackles invisibly in the mid-afternoon sky. About an hour after the checkered flag, a very jet-lagged Danica Patrick, just off the plane from Japan, holds a press conference. It's arguably the most exciting moment of the day. She just has made history, after all. And the organizers of IRL are anxious to get her in front of the U.S. media. Flash bulbs are going off. The conference room is packed.
Well, thank you, everybody, for being here. It's a room full.
She answers the questions that you'd expect to hear. What's it like to be the first woman? Glad to have the monkey off your back? She even addresses the IRL champ car split.
I don't even like to bring it up because it's just confusing. You know, fans don't understand.
Of course, now that it's just the IRL, she won't have to. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Long Beach, California.
Torn between two lovers, feeling like a fool. Loving both of you is breaking all the rules. Torn between two lovers.
You're listening to Only a Game. Fathers and sons play catch. So do fathers and daughters, and mothers and sons and daughters, and as commentator Alyssa Eli recently discovered, sometimes fathers pitch to daughters too, sort of.
Short sleeves are in the air.
And in the park near our house, little children are holding baseball bats while parents are pitching balls and holding cell phones. I saw this variation on the game just the other day. The father was lobbing a rubber ball at his little girl with one hand and talking into his third ear with the other. She looked like she was about three. She grasped her orange plastic bat, its length was more than her height, swung, missed, and waited while he talked, tapping the ground with mighty three-year-old intentions. Clearly they had done this before. They were playing together, yet she was playing alone. Her dad reached into his pocket and pulled out another ball, caught up in conversation that wasn't with her. He threw a second pitch. She swung a few feet away from him and missed again. He motioned for her to throw the balls back, and she loped after them with that heartbreakingly sweet, high-toed amble of little children. Here today, gone next year, transformed before a parent can blink into nothing more than nostalgia and memory. He watched her scurrying around, and you could see his pride and love, but he didn't put down the phone. She scooped up the balls in both hands and threw them in his direction. They rolled about halfway towards him, and he jogged over to meet them. Gently, underhandedly, deliberately, he threw a ball straight into her bat. It was a direct hit. "Hang on," he said into the phone, and then, without shifting it off his ear, shouted to her, "Great job, Sophie!" She looked pleased but confused, and I wondered whether she had grown so used to him talking to someone else that she didn't recognize he was talking to her. But maybe this was just anachronistic longing on my part. Maybe Sophie didn't mind at all. If she doesn't know the game used to be different, she won't miss the time when parents took their children to parks and played with all their hearts.
Writer and psychiatrist Alyssa Eli lives near Boston. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sean Avery of the New York Rangers, known throughout the National Hockey League for such shenanigans as waving his stick in the opposing goalkeeper's face and accumulating myriad penalty minutes, has made plans to work for Vogue magazine when the hockey season ends as an intern. "We are going to have to see how far the Rangers go in the playoffs to determine when he will start," said Vogue's director of communications, Patrick O'Connell. "He'll be answering phones, working photo shoots, getting samples, working the gamut." In taking on Avery, Vogue apparently did not consider the assessment of Pittsburgh Penguin Gary Roberts, who said after a fight with Avery earlier this year, "He's an idiot." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, sports journalist Pat Jordan on the frauds, liars, and good guys about whom he has written. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
In NBA playoff action, Kobe Bryant scored 49 points to lead the Lakers to their second thoroughly convincing win over the Denver Nuggets in Los Angeles on Wednesday night. Those two teams meet again this evening. Any reason to think a change of venue will alter the flow of the series?
I don't know. I think Denver may get one because they're playing in their own building at altitude, but it's very, very similar to the Boston-Atlanta series. You've got one really good team, one really bad team, and this is what happens in the NBA. First-round upsets in the NBA playoffs are very rare things.
Well, I was going to move on to the Boston-Atlanta series. Hawks guard Mike Bibby will certainly enjoy a respite from the booing fans in Boston. He gave them every reason to boo, I guess. But will that be enough to help Atlanta avoid a sweep?
No. I have a feeling they're going to get swept. They don't have enough. They have no answers for the Celtics defense. The Celtics can hold them to a 6 or 8 or 10-point quarter anytime they want to.
Detroit, the Stanley Cup champs 6 years ago, beat Colorado, the champs of 7 years ago, in the first game of their second round NHL series 3-1. Those teams play again tonight. Where's the smart money in that series?
I think Detroit's going to win the series. I think Detroit's playing pretty well right now. They're playing pretty well at the end of the season. The Avs are dinged up. Peter Forsberg's hurt. Wojciech Wolski's hurt. That's not going to help either. I think Detroit moves along.
On Thursday night, the Montreal Canadiens needed an overtime to prevail over the Philadelphia Flyers, but prevail the Habs did. Luckily, Canadiens fans were perhaps too tired to celebrate, as they had when the Canadiens eliminated the Bruins on Monday night.
Yes, they arrested five more people as they were gearing up for the Philadelphia series. Montreal is really playing this entire playoff on a razor's edge. They are not beating anybody, except for the Bruins in the seventh game of their series. They're not beating anybody the way they should beat people.
I have a riddle for you, Charlie.
Okay.
How does a minor league hockey goalie make 98 saves in a single game and still lose 3-2?
Because he didn't make 99 saves.
Or
that's
even
the problem.
100.
Michael Layton of the Albany River Rats, they were playing the longest game in the history of the American Hockey League, which goes back 72 years. He made 98 saves for the River Rats, but he couldn't stop Ryan Patolny at 258 of overtime 5. And the Philadelphia Phantoms won. They beat the Albany River Rats. Michael Layton has now made 98 saves and I'm sure is going out with a very large club looking for his defenseman.
NFL draft day is finally
upon us,
Charlie. I knew that you would be excited, and I'm certainly excited. Those who frequent ESPN have been subjected to weeks, months, perhaps more, of mock draft speculation and draft buzz. I think that's a trademark. Charlie, please explain to me why this event is of such enormous interest to spectators.
Because we are a pathetic, easily distracted nation, Bill. That's why.
Simple answer. In the scandal that will never go away, Roger Goodell is finally set to meet with Matt Walsh, a former Patriots employee, about what Boston sports writers lovingly refer to as Cameragate. No one knows what Mr. Walsh will say, but the fact that he spent 2 months negotiating before he would agree to talk doesn't seem to bode well for the Pats, does it?
Well, on the other hand, the Patriots agreeing not to sue him and agreeing to pay his legal expenses and his airfare to New York from Hawaii, and not to mention the fact that we've now got a flat denial from Bill Belichick, leads me to believe that the Patriots think their case is fairly solid, too.
One of the mysteries of the recently completed college basketball season had to do with why Pat Summitt, the coach of the women's team at Tennessee, wouldn't schedule UConn. UConn women's coach Gino Auriemma said this week that Summitt, quote, lacked the courage to come out and say she thought Auriemma broke the recruiting rules. Can you identify the white hats and the black hats in this one?
I really don't. You've got two monumental egos running headlong into each other, and remarkably enough, it's not Gino Auriemma and Jim Calhoun. It's Gino Auriemma and Pat Summitt. You know, I'm just as glad they don't. I mean, I think that, you know, because of the way that the top level of women's college basketball is so very rigid right now, you know, you'd wind up with Tennessee and UConn playing 2 and 3 times a year, and I don't think that's good. I mean, if they have to play, I'd rather see them play in the tournament than play it in regular seasons.
This season, Danilo Gallinari has been playing his basketball for Armani Jeans Milano. Care to predict where he'll be playing next season?
I suspect he'll be playing in the National Basketball Association. 17 points and 5 rebounds a game for Armani Jeans Milano. He's almost a 40% shooter from three-point. He's a 6'9" jump shooter, once again, from Europe, and is always used for them.
Okay, so care to predict how long it will be before the Sacramento Kings become the Wrangler Jeans Sacramento Kings?
I like the Armani Jeans Milano. That's a
I
nice
wonder
team.
If they get free it's stuff.
Nice, of course they get free stuff. Are you kidding?
Political correctness has apparently claimed another victim in the world of sports traditions, Charlie. The fans of the Detroit Red Wings have been told to stop throwing octopi on the ice after the Wings score. What do you suppose they'll throw instead?
Oh, I didn't know before this whole issue came up that the complaint is not like the delay of the game or octopus smelling or something on the ice. Apparently, octopus shrapnel has been known to go all over the ice and is very hard to pick up and is alleged to be a danger to the NHL players. I never understood what octopuses had to do with the Detroit Red Wings anyway.
I'm not sure the people who throw them do.
But we have been decalamarized in Detroit, and that's not a good thing.
And finally, Charlie, we here at Only a Game are no strangers to silly competitions. We've covered skillet tossing, for example, belt sander racing, even wife carrying on the domestic and international level. But as far as I know, we've never covered an event for which the object is to be the silliest, and perhaps you can explain.
A Polish town has invited John Cleese to judge a Silly Walks competition. Those of us who have a respect for the classics will remember that the famous Silly Walk, Ministry of Silly Walks skit was a Cleese special with Michael Palin as the man who comes in to get a government grant to develop his walk, which, alas, is not silly enough. Apparently, Cleese has done a commercial for a bank in his town in Poland. He's trying to get the bank to let him open an account and claiming that he has no Polish address. His aunt came from a town, and I'm not even going to begin to pronounce this, PCIM. Well, PCIM has decided, they were angry at first, but they decided there's kopecks or whatever to be made in this. So now they've put him on billboards, and now they've invited him to judge a Silly Walks competition.
Charlie Pierce will not be participating in that competition. He's too busy writing for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
As a very young man, Pat Jordan seemed destined to become a dominant major league pitcher. At least, that's what the Braves, then of Milwaukee, thought. They signed him to a large contract. Fault Spring, Jordan's book about how that dream failed, established that the failed pitcher is a terrific writer. A new collection of the magazine writing Pat Jordan has been doing for the past three decades will remind readers that Jordan has achieved what most athletes and writers value most, consistent success over time. Pat Jordan joins me now from WXEL in Boynton Beach, Florida. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Good to be here.
In 1980, you wrote about Steve and Cindy Garvey for Inside Sports. I don't know how many of your potential interviewees read that story, but I found myself wondering if anybody who did read it would consent to be interviewed by you.
Well, my editor at the New York Times years ago said that if I came to his door, he would put his sofa up against the door and the dresser and not let me in. and this is the guy I've been working with for 10 years, you know. But the irony is, if you're a good guy, I'm the best guy in the world to show up at your door because I just want to get you the way you are. I want to capture you as you are. If you're not a good guy, maybe I'm not the best guy to do the story as far as your image is concerned. But my philosophy about that is, if you're a good guy, I can be hard on you because I know the fact that I like you will show through. Mm. And if you're not a good guy and I'm really not crazy about you, I bend over backwards for you because I also know that my dislike will show through. I try to even the playing field for even unpleasant interviews as much as I can.
Well, in that aforementioned interview with Steve Garvey and his wife, Cindy, you have Cindy saying, you quote her as saying, "I hope in the next year my husband can develop to keep my interest." Did you think twice about including that remark and remarks like that?
No. You want to know the truth? I'm so conscious of just getting the story right that I don't even think about the result. Sometimes I'll write a story and I'll have something explosive like that in it, and I won't notice it. And then after the story comes out and, you know, everything hits the fan, and all of a sudden I'm being called up by radio stations and so forth, and people say, "Do you realize what you did?" But I don't realize it at the time. I'm so single focus about just making sure I get Cindy's quote right and make sure I get the nuance of the moment right. I don't think about whether the quotes are explosive or not. I mean, you know, maybe sometimes I would, like in the Steve Carlton story.
Oh, yeah.
That I knew, generally I don't.
I want to read a little bit of that piece just to give our listeners a sense of your writing. This is entitled Thin Mountain Air from Philadelphia Magazine in 1994. At one point in that essay, you write, "As a pitcher, Carlton knew his limitations, a mind easily baffled by intricacies. There were so many batters, their strengths and weaknesses confused him, so he refused to go over batters' tendencies in pregame meetings. He blocked them out of his consciousness and reduced pitching to a mere game of toss between pitcher and catcher, his personal catcher, Tim McCarver." A little later in that same piece, To prevent any chattering before a start, he had the Phillies build him a $15,000 mood behavior room next to the clubhouse. It was soundproof with dark blue carpet on the floors, walls, and ceiling. He'd sit there for hours in an easy chair, staring at a painting of ocean waves rushing against the shore. A disembodied voice intoned, "I am courageous, calm, confident, and relaxed. I can control my destiny." Carlton, said teammate Dal Maxville, lived in, quote, a little dark room of his mind. When you visited with Steve Carlton in his concrete bunker in Colorado in 1994, he'd been retired for almost a decade. Were you surprised by the man you encountered at that time?
Absolutely. This is one of the stories that I did for a friend of mine. You know, they weren't paying much money, but he pleaded with me to do it for Philadelphia Magazine. And I knew really nothing about him except as a pitcher, and I knew he didn't like to talk to the press. So, I was going to do this Hall of Fame story. He was going to be elected in the Hall of Fame and inducted in Cooperstown. And the guy I met was somewhat crazy. He started talking about the Elders of Zion and how they control the world, and the United Nations is coming in black helicopters to confiscate all our guns, and on and on and on. And I just let him talk. I mean, I was shocked myself at what he was saying.
One of the more poignant moments in that chronicle of Steve Carlton involves his wife. I came away from reading the story feeling very, very sorry for her.
Well, she divorced him somewhat later, so I guess she finally got the picture. But that was a sad thing. They were sitting in this concrete bunker with only a space heater. It was freezing up there in Durango. And nothing on the walls, no pictures, no clocks. Deeb didn't believe in clocks, no television. It was like it was almost like a cave. It was just a sad, sad situation, at least for her. This is what he wanted, so it wasn't sad for him.
Your portrait of Wilt Chamberlain, which appeared in Philadelphia Magazine 11 years ago, suggests that you found Wilt to be an extraordinarily likable man who had been badly served by the press. How so?
Well, Wilt had so much talent, and he was one of the first of the very talented big men, you know, the guys who could move with the ball and shoot and all that. The expectations on him were always so great that I don't think anybody could have lived up to him, and he did a pretty good job of it, though. But I met him and Bill Russell, and Bill Russell was one of the most unpleasant men I ever met in the business, and Wilt Chamberlain was one of the nicest. And yet their image in the media was the complete opposite. Wilt was the egocentric guy who was only worried about himself, and Bill was a very intelligent, esoteric guy who could talk about anything. But the opposite was true. Wilt was a wonderful man, and I enjoyed being with him at his house. He was terrific. And I think I wrote later in the Q&A that he called up my wife at midnight to talk to her until 2 in the morning. And when I got back home, she was dead tired when she picked me up at 6 a.m. at the airport. And she said, "Wilt was on the phone with me all night." And he was just a great guy.
Once the best sports writing of Pat Jordan had been assembled, did you find you had a favorite among the pieces that had been collected?
Yeah, my favorite was the pork. The 5'5" college basketball player led the nation in scoring. The greatest shot maker I ever knew, and he was an absolute madman. He could go on and on. I told you in the story, one of his friends said he wasn't in shape. We're in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he said, "I'll show you what kind of shape I'm in." And he ran in hard-sole shoes from Bridgeport to Danbury, which was like 50 miles away, while his friends followed him in their car, you know, going 20 miles an hour. He ran there. When he got to Danbury, somebody said, that wasn't much of a run. He said, "I'll run back." And they had to force him to get in the car.
And this guy was a personal friend. I mean, this wasn't just a great basketball player.
Oh, no. He was. The story is I was a 14-year-old kid, and he would have these manic three-man basketball games in his North End Boys Club gym, the kind of games that were life or death. And he was 21 at the time, and I was just a kid. I would watch him. One game, one of his guys got hurt. The score was 11-11 to a game of 12. And Porky yanks me by the shirt onto the court. He said, "All right, we got to finish the game out." He says, "If you get the ball, pass it to me." Game goes on. The ball's bouncing around. I don't know anything. These guys are knocking me all over. They're men, and I'm only a kid. ball lands in my hand at the foul line. I got the ball. I go up. As I'm about to throw a jump shot, Porky leaps at me, his own teammate, and tries to block the shot. The ball goes in. Swish. Porky hits me, knocks me down on my behind on the ground. And I jump up and I say, Porky, we won. We won. And he screams at me. He says, what are you, insane? He says, nobody takes the last shot in Porky's team but Porky. And I became an object of ridicule in the gym. He would grab me. He says, you know how crazy this guy is? He took the last shot on Porky's team. And guys would look at me like I was a madman. And but that's how I know the Pork.
The best sports writing of Pat Jordan is published by Percy Books. Pat Jordan joined me from WXEL in Boynton Beach, Florida. Pat, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a great pleasure, and good luck with the book.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino and Pam Solsek at WXEL in Boynton Beach, Florida. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Gabe O'Connor, who has worked on this program for the past 8 years, is moving on, much to the dismay of all of us who've counted on his expertise and been the beneficiaries of his infectious good humor. Gabe, we wish you the best. If you'd like to see photos of the Toyota Grand Prix in Long Beach, California, or read my review of the best sports writing of Pat Jordan, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. In our final word, eventer Ralph Hill describes what it's like to ride cross-country in a competition such as this weekend's Rolex Kentucky 3-day event.
If you could get half the drug addicts that feel at one time, they'd never do drugs again. They'd have their butt on a horse and running and jumping.
Recreational rehab. Sounds like the sort of thing even Amy Winehouse might embrace. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.